Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Freeman at the side of Ryan, gets the snap, hands off, and here comes Freeman running laterally. He goes over the tackle, the five, runs to the far pylon, dives and falls into the end zone. Touchdown, Atlanta! And Atlanta cashes in on the fumble by the Patriots. On the 19-yard line of New England, Ryan in the gun, looks into the nickel. Drops back five, got a block from the left tackle. Line drive pass back in the end zone, caught on a dive by the tight end Hooper in the back of the end zone. He beat Chung, who is draped all over him.
And you talk about playing downhill and momentum. This goes all the way back to the Garrett Blunt fumble. And since that moment in time, this offense of the Atlanta Falcons has completely woken up.
Brady with his arms outstretched. Hit as he throws, short pass. It's intercepted. It's picked off by Alford. He caught it behind 20. Near side 30. He broke the tackle 40. Down the sideline 50. 40. 30 on the near sideline 20. 10. 5. He walks into the end zone. Touchdown, Atlanta. 82 yards. He returned it. The first pick six by Brady in his Super Bowl career. In the shotgun, Ryan backpedals, throws a short pass. It's caught by Coleman over the shoulder. Five. Far sideline, runs inside the pylon. Touchdown! He beat Ninkovich to the end zone. 6-yard touchdown pass. The second tonight for Ryan. And Atlanta is running away midway through the third quarter. 27-3 over New England. He drops back after the shotgun snap. It's a belt high throw to the far side. Caught by White. Spins and thrives on the far sideline. Touchdown. 5-yard touchdown pass by Tom Brady. They edge closer. 28-9. All put down. Right footed kick is away and hits the upright. No good. What more can go wrong for New England? Shotgun snap on 3rd and 2. 3 minutes in. Here comes Dante Hightower. The ball short free. It flips in the air. Ryan was back to throw. His arm was caught. It's a fumble and it's a turnover. And New England has gotten it. Shotgun snap to Brady. Line drive throw. Goal line diving catch. Belt high. Touchdown. Amendola. Brady in the gun. High snap and it goes in. A direct snap and it goes right to White, who takes it over the center and crosses the goal line. And the 2-point conversion for New England. Now we've got ourselves a ball game. From the New England 36. Shotgun snap on 1st and 10. Brady rears back. Line drive throw. It's deflected. It's up in the air. Edelman was diving for it near the 40-yard line. There is a fight for the ball. Edelman has come up with the ball. Edelman has come up with the ball. Oh my goodness, what a play, with the ball literally inches above the turf. Brady is under center. Inside the one. Five on the line. Brady gets the snap. Spins. Hands off White. Knights in. Touchdown. New England. 1-yard touchdown. White. It's a 2-point game with 57 seconds remaining. Ball at the 2 for the 2-point try. Brady under center. Here comes the snap and a quick throw. And it's caught by Edelman. Got a block and a quick throw near the goal line. Got the ball. And they say he did not get in or didn't catch it. Who was the hit by Amendola?
There's a flag on the play. Yeah. They called it good. Offside on defense. We got us a Celtics high game.
It's good on the 2-point throw to Amendola with a block by Edelman. That ties the game at 28. That's the end of the fourth quarter. Let's go to overtime. We are tied at 28. The first overtime in Super Bowl history. Brady breaks huddle at the 2 of Atlanta. Brady gets the snap, pitches out White, gets a block, cuts inside. He digs, he turns, he dives. It is a touchdown! It is a touchdown! New England wins! The Patriots have won Super Bowl 51 in the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well. You know, one of the hardest things I think to do in life is to change. I think it's one of the hardest things that we are all asked to do at any given point in our lives. Any given point in our time, particularly when we get older. As we get older, I think, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to change because we all become, well, set in our ways, right? Isn't that what they say? You become set in your ways as you get older. You can't ask a leopard to change its spots kind of thing. We evolve into what we are based on where we were throughout our young lives, into, you know, juvenile adolescence, into young adulthood, into early adulthood, into middle age. And for our senior friends as they get older, I mean, you spend all of this time becoming what you are eventually supposed to be. And it's hard. It's very hard to change. It's hard to change who we are and what we believe. It's even harder once you recognize the change is happening to admit that you're changing. It's even harder when you admit that you're changing to explain to others why you are changing and how you are changing. People come to know you as a certain thing. People come to expect you to be, you know, what you have always been. Yeah, I know that guy. You ever do that? You ever meet somebody? Or not meet somebody. Run into somebody who knows somebody else. Hey, you know, I know somebody who knows you. Yeah, new guy started working in my building. He says he used to go to school with you. It's Jim. Oh, really? Yeah, I know that guy. And, you know, smart kid, smart dude. At least he was smart when I was younger. I remember that guy, yeah. I believe he still plays a lot of slow pitch softball. Yeah, real good dude. I remember that guy. Softball? No, I've never seen him swing a softball bat in his life. He's a gearhead. He's got like 20 classic cars and he tricks them out all the time. Really? Wow. I didn't know that. People change through the years. I find myself after watching one of the greatest football comebacks. I'm not going to call it one of the greatest football games in history. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be a part of that. I'm not going to say prisoner of the moment, greatest game I've ever seen. I remember being prisoner of the moment after the Green Bay-Dallas NFC divisional round game. I said one of the greatest games I've ever seen. And it probably still was the way it ended. But I'm not just going greatest game here. Talking about one of the greatest comebacks I have ever seen in team sports history. Going through all team sports, one of the greatest comebacks ever. And on the heels of watching Tom Brady put together his career masterpiece at nearly age 40, let me say that again. Dude is 39 and closer to 40. He put together his career masterpiece. His Joe Montana Super Bowl drive. Not one of them, but two of them. Coming in his seventh Super Bowl and his fifth victory. You remember the Joe Montana moment, right? You remember the Joe Montana, we got to go 91 yards, and there's a minute and a half or so on the clock, and everybody is all against the Bengals, everybody's all nervous, everybody's worried in the huddle, and you know, during the TV timeout, he's looking around the stadium, and he says to his guys, "Hey, isn't that John Candy?" And instantly, the tension is eased. Yeah, I think it is. And it's one of the reasons Joe Montana earned the name Joe Cool. Joe Cool, under pressure, always poised. Nothing is too hard for him to handle. Nothing is too intense. Joe Cool. That is one of the great moments in football lore when you start talking about, hey, who's the greatest quarterback back of all time? Johnny Unitas, or is it Dan Marino, or is it Peyton Manning, or is it Tom Brady, or is it Joe Montana, or is it Brett Favre, or is it, you know, all of these different names through the years. And we go through this from time to time. But it's one of the moments that you talk about with Joe Montana. Not only did he finish 4-0 in his career in Super Bowls, he was just unflappable. And that story is told all the time. And it's a drive he became known for as one of the preeminent moments of Joe Montana history. Well, despite all of his accomplishments and his own four Super Bowl championships going into yesterday and six Super Bowl appearances, which is just mind-rattling stupid. It's just you can't fathom that. And then yesterday being seven, what? He didn't have one of those Joe Montana, Joe Cool drive moments. Montana had that in the Super Bowl. Elway, of course, had the championship game drive against the Browns that became known as the drive. But Brady, for all of his superlatives, for all of his records, for all of his championships, for all of his brilliance, didn't have that one in order to win yesterday. In order to beat the reigning NFL MVP, Matt Ryan. In order to beat him, he had just been crowned MVP the day before. He would need not only one of those drives to cap off a comeback from a 25-point deficit midway through the third quarter. He would need to then win the coin toss and then engineer another one to put the game away, knowing that it had to be another full length of the field drive, not just get down into field goal range. We know the new, relatively new, NFL overtime rules. A field goal is not the automatic instant winner the way it used to be. Both teams must possess the ball at least once, unless the team that gets it first scores a touchdown and puts the game away. Tom Brady wasn't going to settle for three. He wasn't going to just mount that incredible, monumental, impossible 25-point comeback only to just get three in overtime, giving the ball back to the new MVP, Matty Ice, so that he could go back down and carve once again and win it on a touchdown. Tom Brady needed not one but two drives to win a championship, to break the four title tie that he had been in with Montana and Bradshaw, to cement his legacy as what we have come to know, thanks to, I think, probably Muhammad Ali first, but then maybe Usain Bolt, who popularized it. But the term GOAT has been flying around for the last decade or so. People get tattoos of the word GOAT, G-O-A-T, all capital letters, of course, because we're not talking about what GOAT used to mean in sports vernacular. The guy who screwed it up, the guy who lost the game, the goat's horns, the guy wearing the goat's horns. No, capital G-O-A-T, greatest of all time. So let's get back to my original question. How hard is it to change? I'm a guy who grew up in Cleveland, and like most Northeast Ohio fans, Browns fans, all, extraordinarily disappointed with the circumstances that led to the Cleveland Browns moving in the mid-1990s. The last coach before Art Modell decided it was no longer profitable enough to keep one of the most storied franchises in all of professional football history in its hometown. The last coach was, of course, Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick, before he exited stage left, and before the Browns exited for Baltimore stage right, one of his last dramatic moves was, of course, the cutting, the releasing of the hometown fan favorite, the legendary Bernie Kosar. Like almost all Browns fans, I and others have hated Bill Belichick pretty much ever since. Regardless of whether or not it was the right move, we hated the move. It turned out to be the right move. Bernie Kosar never started again in the National Football League on his own merits. He became a backup who started only when the starter got injured. It was true, Bill Belichick was right, but we hated him. We hated his quiet way, his rude treatment of media, which of course at the time, for a guy who had accomplished nothing in 1993, he had accomplished nothing, was incredibly arrogant. Who does this little smarmy punk think he is that he can just sit here and mumble things at you and expect that to be okay? We have a right to know! Very, very different than the guy 20 years later who mumbles things, but he mumbles them from behind a whole mountain of gold and diamonds and trophies and rings. So it's excused. But those of us for years who hated Bill Belichick went on to hate Bill Belichick in New England. And we hated Bill Belichick in New England because it was New England. And when he found the unholy alliance that he forged with Tom Brady starting to win Super Bowls as far back as 2001, starting to become what many analysts believe is one of the greatest coaches of all time. Wait, what? What are you saying? Bill Belichick? No way. He got lucky. Then winning more championships? Well, maybe it's not luck, but it's cheating. Tom Brady? Noodle arm? Are you kidding me? He benefits from Belichick. Bill Belichick? Wait, what? Are you kidding me? He benefits from Tom Brady. We couldn't make up our minds. We couldn't make up our minds which guy we hated more. Which guy we were most jealous of? Which guy was responsible for the other guy's success? Belichick's overrated. He wouldn't win squat if he didn't have Brady. Wait, are you kidding me? Brady is so overrated. He wouldn't win squat if he didn't have Bill Belichick's system. We couldn't make up our minds what we hated. We couldn't make up our minds what bothered us more. And for years and years, I've been on that train. I've been anti-Patriots, anti-Belichick, anti-Brady, even though Brady really never did anything obnoxious to earn enmity and hatred from any fans. Brady didn't do anything to slight my city or my hometown franchise. Brady didn't do anything. He didn't get himself arrested with a gun. He didn't get himself caught up in domestic abuse. He didn't get himself caught up in drugs. He didn't get himself caught up in berating reporters. He didn't crash his motorcycle and nearly kill himself, a la Ben. All Brady did was pretty much win games, smile, say polite, humble things in front of the camera, go home to his supermodel wife, girlfriend first, then wife, and prepare to win more games. There's no reason to hate him, but we did. Jealousy can be a very, very, very dangerous thing. Yesterday I changed. The point of this monologue is to say that as hard as it is to say that we're changing, whether it be due to age, evolution of thought, new information that becomes available, whatever it is that makes us change. Some people have political conversions. My political conversion came years ago. I started believing things that I never believed as a younger man, and I believe them now. But for whatever reason that we change, it happened to me yesterday. I cannot hate the Patriots any longer. I cannot hate Bill Belichick any longer. I cannot hate Tom Brady at all. As if I really ever hated him in the first place. I kind of more hated him because his rival was one of my favorite players in Peyton Manning. And that was his chief rival during his career. So if you're Team Peyton, you kind of have to hate Team Brady, right? Well, not really, and not anymore. Yesterday, I changed. Yesterday, I figured out what it means to respect greatness. To recognize it, acknowledge it, embrace it. And that's what Tom Brady and Bill Belichick forced me to do. Enough of Deflategate. Enough of Spygate. Enough of privilege and prestige. Enough of the Tuck rule, enough of the luck that came along and that enabled and aided this thing. Enough of all of that. It's time to recognize greatness where it exists. What we watched yesterday was a team that is probably the only team in the National Football League and maybe any other franchise that could face the circumstances it was facing. That could face a 25-point middle of the third quarter deficit against the highest scoring offense in the National Football League. A team that had been carving them up. And to face that circumstance, not with panic, not with great despair, but instead with calm, poise, and an internal belief that there is nothing that we cannot accomplish. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens by design. That happens because a system has been put into place that has been tested and tried and true, proven to be true, over the course of 20 years. That's how that happens. They put a system in place. It's called the Patriot Way that says we will not stop because we are never out of the game. Until there are zeros on the clock, we are never out of the game. We will make adjustments. We will change this. We will change that. We will change the next. But we are not done until we decide we are done. And we won't make that decision until there are zeros on the clock. I watched Bill Belichick and his quarterback orchestrate one of the most remarkable comebacks since Lazarus rose from the dead. I watched a perfect storm. We all were witness to a perfect storm. Every single mistake that the Atlanta Falcons made, the New England Patriots capitalized upon. Every single mistake, any error, any lapse, the Patriots needed to capitalize upon. For a comeback of that type to be possible, two things have to happen. One, the team that is in charge absolutely has to choke. The team that is in the lead, that is in control, must make mistakes. For a perfect game by the other team will not be enough to come back from 25 down in a championship game by itself. The only way it is enough is if the leading team also makes the exact number of mistakes that they need to. If the Falcons make a single mistake that New England doesn't capitalize upon, the Falcons still win. If New England makes all kinds of terrific plays, but the Falcons don't make any mistakes, Atlanta still wins. They had to be more than perfect in the second half last night, from midway through the third quarter to the end of the game and through the overtime, and that's exactly what Tom Brady forced them to be. It's exactly what Bill Belichick had built and created in order to be. And that's why I've changed. Never again are you going to hear me griping about the Patriots, ripping them and criticizing them and rooting for everybody to beat them except the Seahawks, which is kind of how I was a couple of years ago. Anybody, never rooted for the Patriots against anybody until they got up against Pete Carroll's smug butt, and I said, you know what, I hope the Patriots beat them. Against everybody else, I've rooted for the everybody else. My two favorite teams have been the Cleveland Browns and whoever's playing the Patriots. And sometimes whoever's playing the Ravens or the Steelers, just depending on circumstances. But the hatred for the Patriots has always been real. Today, I renounce all of the above. Why? Because I refuse to allow greatness to go unrespected or disrespected. How many times have I told you on this program, if you've listened to me with any regularity at all, when we talk about fighters, when we talk about tennis players, when we talk about golfers, and yes, when we talk about team sports, I love history. I'm a history buff in world history as well. From wars to revolutions to eras to economic collapses and recoveries, I'm a student of history. And I'm a student of sports history. And I love history. And I love watching history happen. That's why the whole Tiger Woods saga continues to disappoint me. Because I'm not going to get to see that history of him continue to chase Jack. It's why I loved what Serena Williams and Roger Federer did last weekend in Australia. Breaking ties, reestablishing the truth that they are indeed the greatest individual players in women's and men's tennis history. Sorry, Martina Navratilova. It's no longer even close. It's Serena Williams. Sorry about everything, Pete Sampras. Sorry about it, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, Rod Laver, anybody. Sorry, it's Roger Federer. I love history. I love seeing these things happen. And I'm not going to deny that Tom Brady any longer isn't the greatest quarterback ever to put on football cleats. What he did was simply mesmerizing. And he did it the way he has always done it. And this is something, again, where we change. And I've had to admit, he has done it with nothing but pure class. He doesn't rub anybody's nose in it. He doesn't embarrass a reporter. He doesn't stick a middle finger up in the face of an opponent. He's done it with class every single step of the way. We as a nation have become the nation of mediocrity in many ways. We celebrate mediocrity and we disincentivize achievement. We stop handing out titles like valedictorian at graduation class and salutatorian. Why? Because those who wanted to be valedictorian and salutatorians had their feelings hurt and they didn't achieve. So he said, you know what? We won't have those titles anymore. You guys are all awesome. We stop holding all-star games in Little League Baseball. Why? Because some parents complained that their kids didn't make the all-star team. It hurt their young feelings, sent them into an emotional trauma. So we canceled all-star games. Everybody's great. We overtax the successful businessman who has put his own life on the line. He put all of his capital into a gamble, a dream, an entrepreneurial venture that worked out. But he makes too much money, so we're taking more of that away to give it to the guy who tried and failed, or the guy who didn't attempt at all. We disincentivize achievement. One more on the graduation thing, just because we're coming up to graduation season in a couple of months, of course. Remember when you walked during your graduation ceremony that a few of the students had gold cords around their necks? Being recognized as honor society members, right? National Academic Honor Societies. Yeah. Do you know that there are many, many schools who no longer give out the gold cords? Why? We don't want to separate those high-achieving students from everyone else. It makes them look better, superior, more achieving than everyone else, and that's not fair to the other graduates. So they took them away. We have stopped celebrating greatness. We have stopped celebrating success. We have stopped incentivizing accomplishment and started to encourage mediocrity. Participation ribbons for all. Screw that crap. As for me, I am going to celebrate achievement and I'm going to recognize greatness whenever I see it and wherever I see it, even if I see it in a place where I previously didn't like it. The New England Patriots are the model franchise in all of professional sports. The New England Patriots are run by the coach who should be the model for every coach in professional team sports. The New England Patriots are quarterbacked by the man who should be the model of all quarterbacks or other team leaders in all of professional sports. I'm going to say it. Give them their honor cords. Give them their yellow honor cords. Call them valedictorians. Call them salutatorians. Call them champions. Call them anything you want. But call them the greatest. Because they're 5 championships in 7 years, in 7 Super Bowl appearances, and Tom Brady's 5 and Bill Belichick's 5. Against those circumstances, against that Atlanta Falcons team, the way they were playing on that night, never should have happened and never would have happened without the ultimate in greatness. I am ready to make that change. I am ready to admit that I was wrong in my thinking, I was wrong in my feeling, and I am now ready to do the right thing. To the New England Patriots, my apologies. I will not cheer against you. I will not root for your failure the way I have for so many years. I will simply recognize greatness while it exists before me. And I hope you will join me in doing the very same thing for the New England Patriots.
Can you dig it?
More coming up after this on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
The obvious question in sports talk radio today, how much of it was Tom Brady's greatness? How much of it was Julian Edelman's circus-like catch? How much of it was Bill Belichick's amazing Patriot Way game plan? And how much of it was absolute ineptitude by head coach Dan Quinn, who inexplicably left his team with 0 timeouts with the game on the line after the Patriots came down and tied it with not one but 2 incredibly long drives and not one but 2 two-point conversions. And then, of course, the overtime drive. Dan Quinn left himself without any timeouts whatsoever for Matt Ryan to work with. And Kyle Shanahan, of course, inexplicably decides to continue to throw the ball with 4 minutes to go and the Super Bowl locked up with a simple field goal, making it a 2-score game. I mean, how much of this is the Patriots' domination for the last quarter and a half, despite the Falcons' complete domination for the first two and a half quarters? And how much of it was the Falcons just dripping it down their little legs, just unable to handle the pressure of the moment? I said on Friday when we did our prediction segment on this radio show about the Super Bowl, and Jim Cushlin, if memory serves, you picked the Patriots to win, what was it?
I picked them, I believe it was 27-20, I said.
27-20, and I predicted that they would win 38-34. And we had a couple of other people making picks as well. They were somewhere in the same neighborhoods. We had a few people who picked the Atlanta Falcons. And the one thing that I said, I can't quote everybody else and go back and listen to it, but the one thing that I said is there is simply no accounting, no way you can on paper account for the experience of having been there, not just once, but twice. Not just twice, but thrice. Not just three times, but four. And all the way to the seven times now that Brady and Belichick have been there. And also to a large majority of the roster that was there 2 years ago when the Patriots, of course, got the great pick from Malcolm Butler on the goal line of Russell Wilson to win this thing 2 years ago. There is nothing you can possibly substitute for that. I don't care how fast and shifty Devontae Freeman is. I don't care how solid Tevin Coleman is. I don't care how acrobatic and unbelievably muscular and dramatic Julio Jones is. And I don't care that the MVP had an MVP-type game in the limited number of snaps that he got. There is no way to account for experience in big-game situations. And that is exactly what propelled, in my mind, the New England Patriots to the World Championship. They didn't panic. They didn't freak. They didn't fall into despair. They simply said, let's go to work. And we'll make the adjustments. We'll figure out where the rush is coming from. What stunts and games are they putting on us to get to Tom Brady to knock him down 16 times in three quarters with just the front four without even blitzes? We'll figure out where that's coming from. We'll adjust to that. We'll look at the zone coverage and see where the holes are. We'll get that. Defensively, We'll figure out exactly what it is that they're doing to us in the running game that makes us have to keep linebackers up, which exposes the center of our zone defense to the holes that Matt Ryan can exploit. I mean, every adjustment that needed to be made was made. Do you know that the Atlanta Falcons, after they had secured their 28-3 lead, ran the ball just four more times? Wait, what? What is that? Is that New England taking something away? Is that Kyle Shanahan freaking out and losing his mind? How can anybody explain? How can you explain? How would you try to explain? Kyle Shanahan with a first down and 10 to go on the 22-yard line with 4 minutes to go, continuing to throw the football, putting his team and his quarterback at risk of A, a quarterback sack, B, maybe a holding penalty, something that could knock them out of field goal range, because that's exactly what they got. A little bit of each, a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. How are you not sitting there with field goal range, running the ball once, twice, three times, take some time off the clock, bring in your kicker, make this a two-score game, make it an 11-point game, and then just coast to victory? Instead, Shanahan continued to double down. Now we got it. It's 3rd and 23. We got to throw the ball. Oh, we got a hold. Now we're not even in field goal range. We got to punt the ball to Tom Brady, challenging him to go 91 yards and get a 2-point conversion to tie the game. Did anybody doubt that he would do it at that point with all of the momentum going the way it was? No way. No way. And a good friend of mine, after it happened, texted me immediately and said, Patriots are going to win the toss, Brady's going to go down, and they're going to score 6 Super Bowl over. There is not a chance that the karmic fates would ever let that coin toss go to Atlanta in that point. After they tinkled a 25-point lead away down their legs, there is no way they were going to get the ball back first in overtime. It was going to be Brady. It was going to be Belichick. Sure enough, it was. And sure enough, as I described, they weren't going to go down there and get 3 and give Ryan a chance. They were going to go down there and get 6, sudden death, game over, done. And that's exactly the way it should have played out. I am simply stunned at the monumental amount of mistakes that the Falcons made to allow the Patriots to do this to them. And I am not stunned that the Patriots were ready and prepared to take advantage of every single one of those opportunities to make it happen. So which was it? Is it more of column A that the Patriots simply, with their experience and their talent and Tom Brady's otherworldly... Did you hear what Jeff Saturday said about this? Among the many analysts yesterday, after that game, on Fox and really around the channels. Among many of the many analysts, Jeff Saturday, the former All-Pro center for the Colts, I should say, worked with Peyton Manning for so long. Jeff Saturday said in one of the post-game analyses yesterday that what you saw from Tom Brady is not something that comes from the head, and it doesn't come from the arm, it doesn't come from, you know, prep. He said he has something in his soul that makes him grab these types of moments and take them and do the thing that he did. It's almost bordering on the mystical, bordering on the experience, or not the experience, the existential is what I'm trying to say. The mystical, the existentiality, the karma, whatever it is, it's in his soul. Is it that, or was it just, you know, Super Bowl rookie mistakes from Dan Quinn and from Kyle Shanahan and from Matt Ryan to a lesser extent? To the defense, what exactly was it? Which one was it? I'll tell you this. The one thing that I saw yesterday, Jim Cushlin, do you remember after the NCAA championship game last month when Clemson completed that improbable, not impossible, comeback against Alabama? Do you remember what we started to talk about ever so briefly about the run of championship games that we have seen in American sports over the past year?
Honestly, yeah, I was thinking about that late last night and earlier today, too. It's incredible. Literally, if you just throw out the Stanley Cup Finals, no offense, Pittsburgh Penguins, both college titles and the remaining three pro sports titles,
let me run it down.
Ridiculous.
Let me run
ridiculous.
It down. I was thinking about this morning, in fact. Because it is ridiculous. I want to go back to last April to start this, okay? Last April, the NCAA Men's National Championship game between Villanova and North Carolina. Do you remember the last 15 seconds? The last 15 seconds of that game between Villanova and North Carolina. See if this, let's get inside the Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine here, and let's try to go back in time. Down by three, North Carolina hits an off-balance three to tie the game at 74 with 4.7 seconds left. 4.7 seconds left, Villanova. What are you going to do with them?
Go length of the court with Archie Diacono. 3 seconds at midcourt. Jenkins gives it to Jenkins for the championship.
Literally at the horn. Literally at the horn. The shot is in the air as it sounds. And it splashes from three. Jenkins, 77-74. An unbelievable Villanova win over North Carolina, number two over number one, in an epic, epic NCAA March Madness championship game finale, which was one of the greatest things that I've ever seen. But not for very long, because that was in April. And only a couple of short months later, in the month of June, what did we see and what did we experience? We experienced the team with the greatest single season record in the history of the National Basketball Association. The Golden State Warriors, with a record 73 wins, leading the Cleveland Cavaliers 3-1. But then, suddenly, amazingly, shockingly, forced into a game seven. A game seven at Oracle Arena. Still perfect scenario for the Warriors to win yet another championship. And in game seven, and a series in which the Cavaliers had been trailing 3-1, what did we get? We got the block, the shot, and the stop. Back to back to back. This is what we got.
Irving and Curry, one-on-one. Irving puts it up. It's good! Kyrie Irving from downtown! Wild picks up Curry. Curry steps back, fakes a three, drives again, shut off nicely, found a Green, seven to shoot. Curry fakes the three, steps back, crossover, puts up a three. Rebound James with 30 seconds remaining. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again.
We got the block by James, the shot by Irving, the stop by Love on Curry. The big three of the Cavaliers winning one of the greatest game sevens in the history of the NBA Finals. But then, just while that high is still wearing off, a couple of months after that, we get to the World Series. The two teams with the longest droughts, the championship droughts, in all of baseball, the Cubs and the Indians, going at it, and it took all seven games, and it still wasn't decided. We needed extra innings in Game 7 of the World Series to find a champion.
Two down. Cubs lead by a run, tying run at first. A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it, throw to Rizzo. It's in time! And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The longest drought in the history of American sports is over.
That happened all in the same calendar year. We had the Nova over North Carolina. We had the Cavaliers come back against the Warriors. And then, of course, we had the Cubs coming back from also down 3-1, just like the Cavaliers did, to win Game 7 in extra innings. But we're not done there, because a couple of months after that, that was early in November, a couple of months after that, which means last month, in the month of January, what else did we have? Now it's National Football Championship time. And what do we have? The unbeatable, unstoppable, indescribable Nick Saban-led Alabama Crimson Tide just putting one on the upstart Clemson Tigers until the comeback for the ages was capped by Deshaun Watson.
If Bama can hold him out, perhaps a field goal attempt for overtime. Watson. Touchdown! Hunter Renfro. Little man makes another enormous play. 1 second remaining.
1 second remaining. And that takes us less than 1 month after that to what happened yesterday in Houston, Texas, in Super Bowl 51, the first overtime game in the history of the Super Bowl.
That they're looking for down here.
The great Tom Brady had completed 10 in a row. Now second and goal.
Green 19!
Toss to White. He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth! What a comeback!
Has there ever been, and this might be a rhetorical question, has there ever been a 10-month span where we could argue, could say that we arguably have seen the greatest games in each of the championships of each of those respective sports? Like I said, it might be a rhetorical question. You could argue that that Villanova finish was as good as any finish of any national championship game ever. Maybe with the exception of the slam dunk in 1983 for North Carolina State over Phi Slammajama with Jim Valvano. But you know what? A buzzer beater like that, just as dramatic. Just as dramatic, especially since it matched a buzzer beater, you know, to tie it just, you know, 4.7 seconds earlier. But you have that. Then you could have this. A lot of people, do you remember, Jim? A lot of people nationally, not just people from Cleveland, Ohio, said that that was the greatest Game 7 in NBA championship history, and that that series coming down from 3-1, the way the Cavs did over the Warriors against a team with 73 wins, was the greatest NBA finals of all time.
I absolutely remember that, and maybe my bias kicks in, but I lean right towards the affirmative in both of those cases.
You can certainly make that case. The World Series, seven games. We've seen seven gamers before. Extra innings in Game 7? Between the two teams that had the longest droughts in history,
and
one of them the
108-year
drought, plus the fact that it was also a 3-1 series comeback, many have argued that that was the greatest World Series and the greatest Game 7 in history. We could make that case as well. The college football national championship game I just played, 1 second left, Deshaun Watson gets Hunter Renfrow in the right corner of the end zone to beat Alabama. And now the Super Bowl, first overtime game in the history of the Super Bowl, should speak for itself. Is it the greatest game ever? Maybe. Is it the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history? 25 points down? 25 points down halfway through the third quarter?
Not just that, Bob. But
31 straight points?
This is the point where I throw out there, I was recapping some things, rewatching some of the game earlier today, and I caught something I must have missed the first time. Early in that game, when it was 14-0, they made a notation that 13 was the largest Super Bowl comeback ever.
And they nearly doubled it with 25.
Yep.
Think about that. So just that run from April of last year, the NCAA title game, Cavaliers in the NBA Finals, Cubs and Indians in the World Series, Clemson and Alabama in the National Championship game, and now Super Bowl 51. I think that 10-month run, and I'm not a historian to the point where I'm Elias Sports Bureau, but I would challenge Elias or anybody else to go find me 10 months in any 10-month span, whether they were in one calendar year or they crossed from one year to the next like this one did in 2016-17. Find me another 10-month span where we had those championship game finishes to rival the five that I just shared with you. I just don't think it's possible. And I to say that this is a glorious, glorious age right now of sports would be an understatement. Okay, I know it's top of the hour. Got to get out. Going to get a quick time out of here, get a sports center. Going to come back and talk to our good friend Dennis Maniloff for some analysis of Super Bowl 51, Tom Brady's greatness validated, Bill Belichick's greatness validated, hatred gone. I'm a changed man. I am no longer going to squash or try to condemn or criticize great achievements made by people I don't like. I'm going to simply honor and recognize greatness where it exists. My God, what a great, great, great event we saw yesterday. And I don't care who you were rooting for. More coming up right here on the Extreme.
Freeman at the side of Ryan, gets the snap, hands off, and here comes Freeman running laterally. He goes over the tackle, the five, runs to the far pylon, dives and falls into the end zone. Touchdown, Atlanta! And Atlanta cashes in on the fumble by the Patriots. On the 19-yard line of New England, Ryan in the gun, looks into the nickel. Drops back five, got a block from the left tackle, line drive pass back at the end zone, caught on a dive by the tight end Hooper in the back of the end zone. He beat Chung, who is draped all over him.
And you talk about playing downhill and momentum. This goes all the way back to the Garrett Blunt fumble. And since that moment in time, this offense of the Atlanta Falcons has completely woken up.
Brady with his arms outstretched. Hit as he throws, short pass. It's intercepted. It's picked off by Alford. He caught it from high 20. Near side 30. He broke a tackle 40. Down the sideline 50. 40. 30 on the near sideline 20. 10. 5. He walks into the end zone. Touchdown, Atlanta.
82 yards. He returned it. The first pick six by Brady in his Super Bowl career. In the shotgun, Ryan backpedals, throws a short pass. It's caught by Coleman over the shoulder. Five. Far sideline, runs inside the pylon. Touchdown! He beat Minkovich to the end zone. 6-yard touchdown pass. The second tonight for Ryan. And Atlanta is running away midway through the third quarter. 27-3 over New England. He drops back after the shotgun snap. It's a belt high. Throw to the far side. Caught by White. Spins and thrives on the far sideline. Touchdown. 5-yard touchdown pass by Tom Brady. They edge closer. 28-9. All put down. Right footed kick is away and hits the upright. No good. What more can go wrong for New England? Shotgun snap on 3rd and 2. 3 minutes in. Here comes Dante Hightower. The ball charged free. It flips in the air. Ryan was back to throw. His arm was cut. It's a fumble and it's a turnover. And New England has gotten it. Shotgun snap to Brady. Line drive throw. Goal line diving catch. Belt high. Touchdown. Amendola. Brady in the gun. High snap and it goes on a direct snap and it goes right to White, who takes it over the center and crosses the goal line. And the 2-point conversion for New England. Now we've got ourselves a ball game. From the New England 36. Shotgun snap on 1st and 10. Brady rears back. Line drive throw. It's deflected. It's up in the air. Edelman was diving for it near the 40-yard line. There is a fight for the ball. Edelman has come up with the ball. Edelman has come up with the ball. Oh, my goodness, what a play with the ball literally inches above the turf. Brady is under center, inside the one. Five on the line. Brady gets the snap, spins, hands off White. Knights in, touchdown! New England, 1-yard touchdown, White. It's a two-point game with 57 seconds remaining. Ball at the two for the two-point try. Brady under center. Here comes the snap and a quick throw, and it's caught by Edelman. Got a block and a quick throw near the goal line. Got the ball, and they say he did not get in or didn't catch it. Who was the hit by Amendola?
There's a flag on the play. Yeah. They called it good. Offside on defense. He got himself a tie game.
It's good on the two-point throw to Amendola with a block by Edelman. That ties the game at 28. That's the end of the fourth quarter. Let's go to overtime. We are tied at 28. The first overtime in Super Bowl history. Brady breaks huddle at the two of Atlanta. Brady gets the snap, pitches out wide, gets a block, cuts inside. He digs, he turns, he dives. It is a touchdown! It is a touchdown! New England wins. The Patriots have won Super Bowl 51 in the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know, after all of what we just talked about in the first hour, the one thing that I really kind of forgot to talk about and really does deserve at least a second before we go to our guest, our good friend Dennis Maniloff, we got to recognize Bob Kraft. What Bob Kraft said yesterday, what Bob Kraft did yesterday in reminding the world of exactly what the Patriots went through to get there and what drove them and what motivated them without actually coming out and saying that Roger Goodell can shove it straight up his nose. What Bob Kraft did yesterday, something that should be repeated.
2 years ago, we won our fourth Super Bowl down in Arizona. I told our fans that was the sweetest one of all. But a lot has transpired during the last 2 years. And I don't think that needs any explanation. But I want to say to our fans, our brilliant coaching staff, our amazing players who are so spectacular, this is unequivocally the sweetest. And I'm proud to say, for the fifth time, we are all Patriots. And tonight, for the fifth time, the Patriots are world champions.
And while Bob Kraft shoved that right in the face of Roger Goodell, who suspended his quarterback for the first four games of the season, further trying to tarnish and to tamper with his incredible legacy, while he did that, Roger Goodell got this treatment from not just the Houston crowd, because of course we know that fans flocked to the Super Bowl from all around the country, and I think all around the country we joined them in giving Goodell this reception.
What a wonderful football game tonight. That's what NFL football is all about. Robert, you know.
Can't even hear him. He's on the stadium PA, and you cannot hear him because every single fan in that building, and I swear from around the country, people were booing Roger Goodell's sorry A. I was one of them. Dennis Maniloff is a sports writer extraordinaire for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and for Cleveland.com, the Northeast Media Group. He's also the author from A to Z, Andrew's Disastadel, collection of Plain Dealer sports writer Dennis Maniloff's favorite interviews. D-Man, how are you, my brother?
I'm fine, Bob, and I'll tell you what, it must have been rough if you didn't like Belichick and Brady and the Patriots yesterday. It must have been a tough life for you.
Did you notice, I just spent the last hour, by the way, talking about how I have never rooted for Belichick and the Patriots, and I don't think many people in Cleveland ever have, and you're in Cleveland, and I'm from Cleveland. Jim Cushland is from Cleveland. I mean, I don't know how many people here in Northwest Ohio are from Cleveland, but those of us who have been Clevelanders and remember the whole thing, we haven't rooted for the Patriots or for Bill Belichick, but as I stated in my opening hour, Dennis Maniloff, I am sure as hell done rooting against them. Because I simply have too much respect for what they were able to accomplish. And that comeback under those circumstances, down 25, to the highest scoring team in the National Football League, with halfway through the third quarter, down 28-3. That achievement was something that everybody, I don't care who you are, had better respect and understand and acknowledge. You saw something you may never see again.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, I threw out my list, too. Here's what's interesting. Talk about Cleveland. I threw out my list of, you know, my three greatest coaches that come to mind for me. Belichick, Lombardi, and why am I stammering on this one?
Is it seven?
Belichick. Paul Brown. No, Paul Brown's number one. Belichick, number two.
Oh, you mean Lombardi, NFL only. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and I could add, you know, I would add, you know, somebody like Chuck Knoll in the four spot. But the point is, of the three, Art Modell fired two of them. You know, he fired Paul Brown and he fired Bill Belichick. And there's such a misconception out there, especially nationally, that the media ran Bill Belichick out of town. The media did not run Bill Belichick out of town. And Bill Belichick was intent on coaching the Baltimore Ravens, what turned out to be the Ravens.
Right.
And he was fired by Modell. So, you know, the bottom line, though, is Belichick is a genius. Brady is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, quarterbacks ever. And I'll say this, Bobby. There's so many things that go through your mind when you see a comeback like that. One of them that went through my mind was, you know you're great as a coach and as a coaching staff and perhaps as a quarterback, too, you throw that in, when you're spooking the other team into absolutely stupid decisions. And clearly, in the last two Super Bowls, the Belichick aura has caused the other team both times with, I believe, Quinn on the sideline, Quinn in the booth, because he had the defense for the Seattle
for the Seahawks,
a couple years ago.
That's correct.
Yeah, and it wasn't his fault that Russell Wilson threw an interception at the goal line. It was the play calling on the offensive side. Why you would do that, I have no idea, when you have Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. So the Patriots benefit there. And then yesterday, I mean, indefensible sequence by our buddy Kyle Shanahan. When you're first and 10 at the 22-yard line of New England with 4.5 minutes to go, you run the ball straight up the gut three times. You either force them to call timeouts or you bleed clock, and then you kick a relatively easy field goal indoors to go up 11. And instead, they toss sweep it. Then they try to throw it. Then they have a penalty, then the sack, and then the penalty. Yeah, I mean, no, they outsmarted themselves. And afterwards you hear Quinn say, well, we didn't want to get away from what we normally are. Well, there comes a time in a game where you have to be prudent, okay? You know, the Seattle said the same thing. Well, we want to be aggressive at all times. No, you don't, okay? When you're at the goal line and you have Marshawn Lynch, you don't have to be aggressive with a throw. And in the Atlanta case, you get that to an 11-point game. You do not horse around with toss sweeps and throwing and sacks and penalties.
You're
or disagree?
No, I totally agree. I totally agree, especially, I mean, you know, what they did in that circumstance when they had that first down on the 22-yard line, honestly, is simply indefensible. And now, I'm not sitting here, I'm not going to sit here and attack the San Francisco 49ers, but they have to be right now sitting in San Francisco going, holy crap, did you see what our head coach just did? Our head coach just had a play-calling sequence that cost his team the Super Bowl. That literally should have been about as routine of a field goal as you're ever going to ask for. It would have been a two-score game, and even the great Tom Brady isn't going to have time to get two scores in 4 minutes with Matt Ryan getting the ball back in between them. You know, of course, anything of a short of an onside kick. That should have been a two-score game. He completely lost his mind. He flaked out. I think you used the word intimidated. Maybe you have been intimidated by your opponent to the point where you're just not thinking logically and clearly. But between Shanahan and his inexplicable decisions there, and quite frankly, Dan Quinn for leaving his team without a timeout when they had those precious few seconds left after the game-tying touchdown and second two-point conversion, which, by the way, people I think are totally overlooking how hard it is to make those under those circumstances, and they made them both look easy with the direct snap, the Brady fake, you know, snap over the head thing on the first one, then the pass to Amendola. I mean, but Quinn didn't leave his guy any opportunity to try to make a few throws a la Aaron Rodgers a couple of weeks earlier. well, 3 weeks earlier, I guess, to try to get down there for you know, a game-winning field goal. So the coaching staff, you know, in Atlanta, it's young, obviously. It's Quinn's second year. I don't want to sit here and say, you know, this is going to define his career. But honestly, they did not do themselves any good whatsoever. They were completely outmatched by Matt Patricia in the second half, by McDaniels in the second half, by Bill Belichick in the second half, and, of course, by the greatest quarterback ever to pick up a football in Tom Brady.
Yeah, regarding those timeouts, I don't know exactly how they were caused, you know, what went into them, who might have prompted them. Maybe Quinn wasn't responsible for all of them, but I get your point. And here's the thing. If you're Quinn, I don't know how you sleep, you know, because in your last two Super Bowls, you were with Seattle and you got pinched when you could have won back to back. And then this one, the epic comeback by the Patriots. And then you also start to think too, Bob, okay, how much of it is the greatness of the Patriots coming back and how much of it is the collars getting tight for the Falcons? And quite honestly, and the Falcons failing to execute and making mistakes. And I would put it somewhere around 75-25. I think 75% of the credit deserves to go to the Patriots for what they were able to do. Because even when the other team is making mistakes, you still have to cash it in. You still have to come back from 25 down, midway through the third quarter. But there is a 25% of that, that is on the Falcons, because even as great as the Patriots are, you must close the deal when you are up 28-3. I don't care who you're playing.
I don't disagree one word, Dennis. In fact, Brady said something after the game, kind of close to that. Basically, that any one play in that final quarter and a half isn't made, they don't win. I mean, literally, every single play needed to be made. Every mistake that the Falcons made needed to be capitalized upon. If they fail even a little bit, you can't come back from down 25. Let's see if we can hear this.
Well, there were a lot of plays that Coach talks about. You never know which play it's going to be in the Super Bowl, and there was probably 30 of them tonight. Any one of those would have been different. The outcome could have been different. I'm so proud of
them. Yeah, that line right there. There it is at the beginning of the clip. Any one of those plays goes a different way, the outcome is probably different. I mean, D-Man, it was a perfect storm. A perfect storm of Falcon miscues or mistakes in judgment or fumbles in one case, along with amazing capitalizing plays by the Patriots to take advantage of that. From the element catch, which is simply just remarkable, to every decision and throw by Brady, to Amendola, to James. I mean, my God, how does a guy carry the ball 14 times? Catch the ball 14 times for 110 yards, score 20 points on 3 touchdowns and a 2-point conversion, and not get the MVP. And by the way, I'm not saying he should have, because Tom Brady deserved it, but that's an MVP performance. If any one of those guys or individuals doesn't do what they have to do at that moment, it's a Falcons championship, is it not?
There's no doubt, Bob. And I want to go back to a play, too.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, it's all right. I can't remember if it was even the first half or early in the second half, but there was a play where Brady was hit on a release and the ball just floated up in the air and it was very much available for a pick, and it wound up being caught by Martellus Bennett. Okay? And I'm sitting there going, you know what? That play right there, because this was when the Patriots were way down, whatever it was, late second quarter, early third. And I said, that play right there might have saved the New England Patriots, because if that gets picked, they're in even worse jeopardy than they already are. And then, you know, the avalanche of good plays for the Patriots and bad plays for the Falcons. But here's the thing, too, Bob. You know, we always talk about the fine line between winning and losing, all right? The Belichick-Brady era is phenomenal, of course, and now they're 5-2 in the Super Bowl. You could make a strong case that they could be 7-0, potentially, if not for, incredible performances by Eli Manning and his band of receivers.
Yeah, two plays. So, one to throw to Manningham, which is unbelievable, and the other, of course, the catch by Tyree, which is unbelievable. Absolutely, he could be celebrating seven titles right now.
So on one side, you're talking 7-0, and on the other side, though, you could argue, or you could make a case that potentially he could be they could be 3-4 simply based on the last two Super Bowls when the Seahawks had basically won it and then threw it away, and then the Falcons had a 25-point lead. So and you think about legacies and how they're defined. I mean, how would the Brady Belichick era look if they were 3-4 in Super Bowls as opposed to 5-2? And then, you know, they could obviously say 7-0. And that's not even talking about the close shaves that they had, you know, against the Rams and against Carolina. And I think there's another one in there of the first four.
How sad is it? I mean, we're not sad. How amazing is it that if we lose track of who they played in all these Super Bowls? Think about how many there have been, and think about those achievements that we actually have to figure out a way to keep a database here of all of their opponents and all of the teams that they've beaten.
Yeah, it was Rams, Panthers, Eagles. I remember they. I thought the Eagles was decisive. I thought they handled McNabb and Owens pretty easily.
Well, they didn't handle Owens, which is another story, by the way, who didn't get into the Hall of Fame again.
Total
he
farce.
Had a tremendous Super Bowl, if you recall. But yes, they handled the Eagles. They handled the Eagles convincingly. You're right.
And what was the other one? Rams, Panthers, Eagles, and who? Who's the? What's the one I'm missing? Kush, where are you, Kush? Anyway, that's the fourth one I can't recall at the top off the top of my head. But Brady and Belichick are just absolutely awesome. There's no amount of superlatives. And I'll say this. You know, I know you have to talk about it, and I guess I'm talking about it now, but I'm so sick of Roger Goodell. I'm so sick of the whole Roger Goodell garbage. Oh, what's it going to look like when Roger Goodell shakes Brady's hand, and what's he going to say? Oh, who cares? Roger Goodell gets so much publicity for nothing, you know, and I know that he, you know, thrust himself in the middle of this particular storm, but I just prefer to focus on what Brady and Belichick accomplished and not worry about, you know, that commissioner.
No, you know, I get it, but to me, I think a lot of people care for, I mean, people agree with you, about him. And they wouldn't be giving him all of this attention if it was positive attention. They are enjoying the living crap out of even non-Patriots fans like to see this guy who inexplicably tried to drag its marquee player, his league's marquee player, greatest quarterback of all time, et cetera, through the mud of controversy and discipline. When a court decided you've got nothing here, I'm pressing on, I'm going to appeal that decision. I want my star player to be suspended and to have his legacy tarnished. It is unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. And for the Patriots to find a way to use that as motivation, and make no mistake, you heard it from Kraft, they did, to then win it and stick it in Goodell's ear, I took great pleasure in seeing that. I'm with you. I want to celebrate accomplishment, but I also want to see ignorance, stupidity, and I don't know, find a few other words to describe Roger Goodell for me, but I want to see that, you know, mocked and laughed at vociferously.
Yeah, sorry about the brain cramp from a couple minutes earlier. It was the victims for the Patriots under Belichick were Rams, and then I believe Carolina, then Philadelphia, then, of course, Seattle, and now
there you go.
Atlanta. So there's your five. Yeah,
there you go.
Seattle was the fourth, and Atlanta was the fifth. But, when you think about this season, of course Goodell is going to be in it because of what happened to Brady and the suspension. But the idea that the fact that they were able to overcome that obstacle, you had a potential situation where in those first four games when Brady was suspended, they could have gone 0-4. I mean, who knows? And it maybe lose a home field advantage situation and not be able to have home field and take it to the Super Bowl. So it definitely could have influenced the outcome of the season, but instead they go 3-1 and, you know, they more than are steady going into the resumption of Brady playing. And not only that, Brady comes in week 5 and is lights out. I mean, he plays at an MVP level for the final 12 games. And I'll say this too. You know how Belichick uses everything, okay, Bob? There's no question that Belichick put the Antonio Brown thing up on the big board and played it on the video board for all of his team to see. I don't care what they say publicly. It'll come out at some point. that Brady put the Antonio Brown Facebook, Snapchat, whatever you want to call it, up on the board and let everybody see it. Okay, so they used that for motivation against the Steelers. I promise you they used everything for motivation against the Falcons, including Goodell and the Matt Ryan MVP.
Yep.
I mean, I'm
before,
sure.
I don't disagree, but here's the thing, Dennis, that I might, and I don't want to disagree with you because I think you're right, but I guess maybe I'll be adding on to. Even if they didn't find those slights or perceived slights to use as motivation, they are just more motivated. They are just, the Patriot way means something to them that really nobody else can find. And here's my example of that. Today, at the press conference, Bill Belichick standing there says, look, and I'm paraphrasing, not to take away from the accomplishments of yesterday or the celebration of today, but we're 5 weeks behind the rest of the league in preparing for 2017. He's had to play for the last 5 weeks, playoffs, and then the 2 weeks between the championship game and the Super Bowl. He hasn't been able to put in the prep for the draft, for free agency, for offseason workouts. So this guy, the day after winning his fifth Super Bowl, Dennis, breaking the tie with Chuck Knoll, and of course Brady breaking the tie with Bradshaw and Joe Montana, the day after he's talking about, we're 5 weeks behind, I got to get to work. I don't know anybody who does that. I'm not saying nothing against Mike Tomlin, but would Tomlin have stood there and said, man, we're behind, we got to get to work? If Dan Quinn had won, would Dan Quinn have said, hey, we're behind, we got to get to work? Bill Belichick just won Super Bowl number 5, and he's worried about the fact that the rest of the league had a 5-week head start on him. He's got to get to work.
The ultimate grinder. My dad used to say that when you have the mind, when you have a great mind, you know, that's one thing. But when you add the work ethic to the mind, it's a whole nother ballgame. You go from lethal to real lethal. And the bottom line is Belichick combines the incredible football IQ that's out of this world and the knowledge that he has about the game and about personnel with the work ethic. And that makes him almost indestructible. And yes, he becomes an intimidating force when you play, I mean, from now on, listen, when you play the, I know that when teams play Belichick in the regular season, they never think the game's over. But now in the playoffs too, when you get up on Belichick, you're never going to think the game's over. I mean, now that you've seen what happened here at 28-3, I mean, that gives him another advantage. Because now when a team jumps you and gets up 14-0 or 21-0, you have to remember Super Bowl 51 and say, well, you know what? We like to be celebrating here, but we can't because Belichick's on the other sideline. So that's how good these guys are. And by the way, Bob, all we hear about, the NFL, parity, parity, parity. Really? Excuse me, there's one team out there that's setting the standard, and the rest of them are scrapping around the kitchen floor for crumbs.
Let me ask you one more question, because I got to go make room for the great Paul Keel so we can talk Ohio State basketball.
Paul Keels, I love Paul Keels.
Paul is awesome, and I'll ask him about Super Bowl II, but I want to ask you one more question on Tom Brady and his status as the greatest of all time, and this is the way I want to do this. Tom Brady, in the salary cap free agent era, has had more comings and goings around him in terms of his skill people, in terms of his offensive line, and yes, in terms of his defense, that it's impossible to really comprehend. And yet he has continued this dynastic run of 7 Super Bowl appearances and 5 championships. And I want to compare them this way and to ask you this question, Dennis. In the 1990s, the Cowboys dominated the decade, right? And they had at least 5 players including Troy Aikman, who were NFL Hall of Famers. The great Larry Allen, Michael Irvin, Deion Sanders, and Emmitt Smith. And then, of course, Troy himself. The 80s Niners had 6 Hall of Famers, including Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, Ronnie Lott, Fred Dean, Steve Young, and Coach Bill Walsh. The 70s Steelers had 10. Terry Bradshaw had Franco to give it to. Swan and Stallworth both are enshrined. Mike Webster up front. Lambert, Blunt, and Joe Green on defense. Plus Chuck Knoll and Art Rooney are in the Hall of Fame. I say all of that to say in the Patriots 2001 to now dynasty, how many Hall of Famers has Tom Brady had the privilege of riding along with on this run? I mean, they added Randy Moss for a very short period of time, but it wasn't like, you know, he wasn't Jerry Rice for Tom the way Rice was for Montana and then Young for all of those years. They had Darrell Revis for a minute. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame. But I read a really interesting article. The Hall of Fame committee, you know, I mean, Willie McGinnis, Rodney Harrison, Richard Seymour are names. Junior Seau was there for a little bit. He went in, of course. Ty Law might be. I don't know if I see two, three, four, maybe Hall of Famers since 2001, that since Tom Brady started winning championships, that he has played with. How many Patriots can you think of that you can say, well, Tom Brady is fortunate he had X alongside of him?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bobby. Yeah, you're talking about guys who played with Brady for a set number of years.
Right.
And made it into the Hall of Fame. Let's say even five seasons or six seasons. You know, it is a very small number. It comes down to this with Brady. He's the ultimate winner, just like Belichick. It's a perfect melding of, you know, head coach and quarterback, work ethic, desire, football IQ, talent, obviously. And it also, you think about this. Does the system make the quarterback or the quarterback make the system? And clearly, in this case, the quarterback makes the system. Brady's ability to do what he does, to throw what he throws in windows that he does, to make the decisions he makes, that creates the system that we talk about. You know, that creates the offensive juggernaut. It is because of Tom Brady. And I don't want to hear, okay, they were 3-1 without him in the first four games. It comes down to Brady's ability to create a system that is so dang good.
I mean, here's all you need to know as far as I'm concerned. I just ran some of the names, you know, Montana had Rice and Taylor to throw through and Bradshaw, Swan and Stallworth and, you know, Michael Irvin and Harper. I mean, Tom Brady put together the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history, throwing to Chris Hogan, to Danny Amendola, to Julian Edelman, and handing the ball not to Hall of Famer Franco Harris or to all-timer Roger Craig or Emmitt Smith, the leading rusher, handing the ball to LeGarrette Blount, to James White, to guys who you will never, ever hear of again. He did this with those guys. I don't believe any other quarterback, the greatness of Montana included, could ever have played with this cast of characters on this offense with Martellus Bennett instead of Gronk. There's another great example. Along with the names I just gave you, and could have pulled off a 25-point comeback against the highest-scoring team in the National Football League, the Atlanta Falcons.
I got a research assignment for Kush. I want him to go and research the number of players, the number of running backs with at least 100 postseason rushing yards in Tom Brady postseason games, and the number of receivers with at least 100 receiving yards. I'm talking about total.
Right.
Just to make sure but you think about all of the different interchangeable parts that Tom Brady makes look good. The amount of receivers who have caught at least 100 postseason yards under Brady, and the amount of running backs with at least 100 rushing yards under Brady. It's got to be a staggering number. Obviously, he's played a ton of postseason games. I get that. But the ability to spread the wealth is one of the many reasons he is among the greatest, if not the greatest, QB ever.
Stated perfectly, as always, Dennis Manilow. Thanks for running it down. It's just such a great time to talk football history when you see greatness like this personified. And I really appreciate it. Nobody else I'd rather have done it with. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Bob.
You got it. 4:41. Let's get our quick time out of here. We got to talk to Paul Keels, Ohio State Buckeyes basketball, on our regular Monday segment right here coming up on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And the ball is saved by Michigan. Gets it to Irvin, right point, shoots a three. No good. Rebound under the lid by Cam Williams for Ohio State. And he'll hold on to it and dribble the final seconds off as the Buckeyes come from 11 down and get their third road win of the year, beating Michigan 70-66 here in Ann Arbor.
And we do indeed continue now at 4:48. Apologies to the great Paul Keels, the voice you just heard there on the Ohio State Buckeye Radio Network, and you hear here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Paul, apologies. We are just so Super Bowled up after the amazing game yesterday. We got a little bit behind schedule. Thanks for being patient with us. How are you?
Not a problem. All good. How you doing, Bob?
I'm great. Speaking of the bowl, did you get a chance to watch it last night?
I did, and oh my goodness gracious, just seems to be typical New England Patriots and Tom Brady, doesn't it?
Oh boy, just an amazing, amazing game, and what a remarkable comeback. And you know what, speaking of comebacks, we just heard your call pointing out that the Buckeyes under Thad Matta came back from 11 down to beat Michigan. You know, the Buckeye victories over Michigan in basketball don't always mean as much as they do in football for obvious reasons. But for a team that had lost two straight Big Ten games and three out of four to Northwestern, Iowa, and Maryland, respectively, it was a pretty doggone big win over the Wolverines.
It certainly was, and against a Michigan team that had been playing pretty good at home for the most part. And, you know, it's the only time they play during the regular season, so if a tiebreaker comes into play, that certainly is helpful as far as standings for the tournament. But they're very impressive that, you know, coming from behind, really surviving the runs that Michigan put on them. You know, a change in the starting lineup because of injury, and the guy that was hurt, Jaquan Lyle, was able to get out there and make some key late free throws, and a team that had been struggling to make free throws late in the game holds up their end of the deal. But, you know, the free throw shooting and the rebound are the stats that jump out at you, Bob. But, you know, Michigan was one of the best teams in the nation as far as fewer turnovers committed, and Ohio State forced them into 12. And I think they had, what, maybe 16 points off the turnovers? I don't remember exactly. But a very good victory on the road against a team that had been playing well at home.
To what do you give the most credit for the turnaround? I mean, I get the stats you said that just jumped out, but what led the turnaround from down 11?
I think that it was the fact that everybody that got on the floor contributed, Bob. At one point, starting that comeback, Micah Potter comes in and he hits a three-pointer. Andre Wesson in the last four or five games has been able to contribute not only with points, but with rebounds. And he had four offensive rebounds, I think all of them in the first half. C.J. Jackson at the point guard gave them some better play as far as decision-making and passing than they've had most of the year. And I think it was just the fact that, you know, Mark Loving gave him a double-figure game and a solid game. Jayshon Tate did what he continues to do. Trevor Thompson, after two subpar games, was his old self. So I think the fact that it was really everybody doing their part played a big part in it, Bob.
We are talking with Paul Keels. The Ohio State Buckeyes took down Michigan, their first win in their last three Big Ten games. Jim Cushlin is with us as well here, Paul. Cushlin's got a question for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
And obviously, beating Michigan, as we just said, even if it may not feel as much to a lot of fans out there, it's still beating Michigan at something. That's always good from an Ohio State perspective. The problem I'm looking at still overall, Paul, that brings the Buckeyes up to 4-7. That's tied right now for 10th in the league with Penn State and Nebraska, 14-10 overall. We've kind of brought this up over time. Even wins like this, considering everything else, it's not going to do much for a bubble chances. And I'm starting to think just getting to the NIT at this rate for the Buckeyes would be somewhat of an accomplishment.
You know, and that's kind of been a concern, Jim, that's been around. You know, what's there is the fact that they play, you know, after Rutgers on Wednesday, they play Saturday at Maryland, and obviously that's going to be tough. They still have Wisconsin at home. They've got a road game in Michigan State and a home game against Indiana. So there are some components there that might dress up their resume a little bit. But, you know, quite honestly, the only way they're looking at the NCAA tournament most likely is winning the Big Ten tournament, and it's a real conceivable possibility that they'd have to play five games to do that. So, you know, but I think there's a better than decent chance for them to get to where they can be over 500 going into the Big Ten tournament and at least be in the position to get to the NIT, especially if they can continue to play the way that they did Saturday, that they did last week, even in a loss to Maryland. That was another of those games that they had some good stretches. You know, I think the schedule is going to be a little more manageable than what it was at the start of January. So, you know, there's some opportunities out there for them to try and dress up their resume some.
You know, you Paul, you just listed some of the challenges there, and you're right, wins over some of those teams, especially Maryland, as you point out, and Wisconsin and Indiana, they're big as far as the resume goes. But what about just total victories? Is there a magic number, regardless of who it's against, that you think it would take for them to get in? They got seven regular season games left. They have 14 wins. So to get to 20 victories, which, of course, is a minimum standard, I would imagine, before the Big Ten tournament, you'd have to have one hell of a finish. How many games do you think it would take for them to win to have a shot at the NIT or the NCAAs?
You know, Jim, I don't have a real good answer for that, but because if you look at last year, they were the first ever 11-win Big Ten team that didn't get in the NCAA tournament. Now, they only had one win over a ranked team, so they were lacking a resume victory. I don't know that they can get to double figures, let alone 11. I think what it would take is for them to, you know, against one of those ranked teams they're playing, at least get a split, maybe sweep both, and then get in the Big Ten tournament and maybe knock off a ranked team or two. Then maybe that gets them to where they're maybe on the bubble. And that's a maybe. So I think, you know, there's just been enough damage done right now, but the NCAA tournament hopes are really, really shaky. However, we say all of that. If they can put together a good run, and God, if they're able to steal one Saturday at Maryland, which is a tall, tall order, but we saw Nebraska go in there earlier in the year and do it. If they were able to win a game on the road like that, win a game at Michigan State, certainly those are things that would help them an awful lot. They're in this tricky part where you kind of think, Bob, they don't necessarily need a bye or a double bye in the Big Ten tournament because they need more games. But we know how difficult that can be, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I mean, interrupt. That's a great point. You know, usually you want a bye or a double bye if you can do it, but that's a great point. They need more games to impress committees that are going to be evaluating them. Paul, you've seen everybody. Who's the best team in this conference? I mean, Wisconsin and Maryland are separated by a game. 9-1 for Wisconsin, Maryland at 8-2. Both teams have 20 wins already. Purdue's sitting there a half game behind that at 19-5. And Northwestern is 7-3 and 18-5. Do you have a feel for is there a dominant team in this conference, or is it just that group that really could beat one another on any given night?
You know what, Bob? I think Wisconsin is the best team in the conference, but I also think Purdue might be the best team suited for a long postseason run. Wisconsin, just because of the way they play, but Purdue could better survive a poor shooting night than Wisconsin could. Purdue's got, you know, the great interior play with Isaac Haas and with Biggie Swanigan, and then some outstanding outside shooting when you think about Dakota Mathias and Ryan Klein. Wisconsin, I don't know if they could survive a really bad shooting night. As well as A.J. Happ plays down low, they really need to shoot the ball well. And I don't think we can forget about Maryland, having seen them last week. They've got some impressive freshmen. And Melo Trimble has shown that he's still a very, very special player. But that's a two-pronged answer. I think Wisconsin's the best team, but Purdue might be the best suited for a postseason run.
I love it. That's great. And now that's why we love to have you on, Paul Keels. No simple answers. That's a very good dual response to that question. Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, of course, on the Ohio State Buckeye Radio Network. We'll have Paul again against Rutgers. You'll hear Paul again, I should say, against Rutgers coming up on Wednesday, a 7 o'clock game at home in Columbus. And then, of course, Paul, we'll talk to you again next week. Sound good?
Sounds good, guys. Take care.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it. There you go. The great voice of the Buckeyes, Paul Keels. And that is it. Wow. A lot of stuff that we really wanted to talk about. I appreciate your attention, diligent as you are as a listener. And keep it coming. Tomorrow we got a lot more. I hope you understood what I was trying to say, especially in that first hour about the Patriots. I'm not a homer, and I'm not going to suddenly become a Patriots fan, but I am simply done being a hater. I recognize greatness when I see it, and boy, oh boy, did we see it yesterday. I enjoyed the conversation today. Tomorrow, let's do it again. Drive Time is next. Stay where you are, right here on ESPN 106.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.